web services.
Welcome to the Cloud On Out podcast about all things Amazon Web Services and cloud security. My name is Andreas Wittig. I'm running a two-person software company together with my brother Michael. Check out our solutions, BucketAV, AttachmentAV, HyperEnv, and Marbot. And today I'm joined by Stephen Kunzli, founder of K9 Security and AWS Community Builder. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Andreas. It's great to be here and glad to be back on the podcast.
Yeah, it's your second time. Glad that we do it again. So let me quickly introduce you. So Stephen started his career as a software engineer, and he started building a SaaS solution called K9 Security for IAM access review, policy management, and monitoring. So that's basically when we get to know each other. Stephen is really deep into all things AWS security and especially IAM. So he has also published a book called Effective IAM for AWS, which is guiding developers through every aspect of authentication and authorization in the cloud. And while you're on it, you should also check out Stephen's newsletter, the Effective IAM newsletter, with weekly tips and tricks. I enjoy it every week. I'm a long-time reader. And also, Stephen is an active AWS community member and shares both his learnings about tech and also business. So I'm really glad to have you today.
Oh, thanks for having me on, and that was a good intro. That's what I've been up to this point.
Did I miss anything important, Stephen, in my intro?
No, nothing that we need to cover.
Perfect. So, what interests me, Stephen, is so like Michael and me, you have been doing AWS consulting for many years, and then there came the point where you decided to build a SaaS product with K9 Security. What really was the motivation for doing that? Did you come about around the same pain points in your consulting, or did an idea spark your mind? So what happened? How did that came along?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in the mid-2010s, I was leading cloud migrations as a consultant, helping companies migrate to AWS, putting their applications in containers, using continuous delivery with infrastructure code. And, you know, all that stuff was actually kind of new at the time. So, you know, I used to be big into the Docker space, co-authored a book, Docker in Action, second edition. I was a Docker community leader as well. And, you know, the hardest part about all this fancy stuff that we were doing was actually IAM. So no one knew what their policies did or how to make them do what they intend. And we thought that was pretty important because we were all afraid that Jenkins was going to delete like the production database, or we'd expose a bucket with data. And honestly, just like made me like super nervous. I was like, this is like a really important problem. And with the pace of change with continuous delivery in particular, you know, we were far exceeding the rates at which like normal security sort of analysis and operations were changing things. So, you know, if you're delivering a change a day or more, which was common at the time, you know, there's no way that a monthly or quarterly security review of IAM policies was going to work. And that was even before you account for the fact that like the IAM and security policy frameworks in or capabilities in AWS are so powerful. And you can you have identity policies, you have bucket policies, you have service control policies and so forth, all these different things. And like, how do you even go and collect these things and figure out who has access to what? And it's just not a human scale problem. So I said, like, I want to help cloud and platform teams be confident in what they ship and enable application teams to do the right thing. So did that by building an IAM access analyzer that reports in plain language, like read data and administer resource. And then policy generators that allow you to use that same sort of language to say who should have access to that bucket or key and so forth.
Yeah, well, very cool. Yeah, I remember trying out K9 security and giving it a try. And it was really a cool experience to have a helping hand to do reviews of IAM policies. Because, you know, back when we were doing consulting, when you looked into new AWS accounts from customers, there was a lot of things going on in IAM configuration.
Right.
And it was always hard to get your head around it. So a tool like that really helps. I can clearly see
right.
The vision there.
Right.
So speaking up back to this transitioning from consulting to building a product. So we had always the problem, Michael and me, that consulting pays the bills reliably. So it's kind of hard to switch and transition from a consulting business to a product business where you don't have any recurring revenue at the beginning. So how was this experience for you and how did you handle that?
Yeah, so I had joined we might call it a mastermind now, but it's actually more of it was a coaching program by Philip Morgan called the Expertise Incubator. And it was a group of consultants that were building specializations in order to like basically raise rates, learn how to develop productized services and switch to sort of retainer-based offerings. And, you know, the productized service and retainer-based offerings are classic ways to basically deliver more value and, like, develop reusable components to help scale scale your time and scale your knowledge. So, you know, there's a good book, Hourly Billing is Nuts, and, you know, it helps navigate the transition from, you know, hourly and time-based billing to like a productized service or like, and in particular, like value-based priced offerings. But yeah, so that was the first step that I used is like try to develop some productized services and retainer-based services. And then I split my time essentially half on consulting and then half on product development. And like literally the way I have to do it is like, I have to split it, you know, half and half before and after lunch. Like there's no other way for me to do it. And to compartmentalize what's going on in my brain. You know, other people might have other tactics that work for them, but that was definitely something that worked for me.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, that sounds so basically you made a step in between from consulting paid by the hour to a product with having productized consulting services.
Yeah.
So that sounds like an interesting way to accomplish that. Thanks for sharing that. So you know, everyone when looking into IAM policies and configurations, everyone says they are doing least privilege, and on paper, probably everyone is. But what is your pragmatic advice for engineering teams who really want to get there, who really want to achieve having set up their IAM with least privilege in mind? So what's your advice?
So I think the first thing to do is define what least privilege is going to mean in your organization. And I think as you're doing that, you're going to have to address like, well, what kind of privileges do we have right now? And then, you know, what do we mean by least privilege? And like, what is our target? I think that a practical target for most teams starting out on this journey is to first understand who has IAM admin privileges and thus full control over the account. They can change security policies. They can mint keys, stuff like this. And then focus in on who has access to your top three or five, maybe, data sources. And that usually generates enough activity of like, oh, wow, we didn't know that there are, you know, there are like three unexpected admins in production. And it's usually not something nefarious. It's usually like, oh, we had an operational incident 2 years ago, and we put additional privileges on this application, and then we forgot to take them off. Now, the problem is that if and when that application is breached, now the attacker can take full control of the account, and you have a persistence problem and so forth. So it's important to, you know, go and take care of, you know, figure out who the admins are, right size those, go figure out who has access and what kind of access they have to your critical data sources. Can they read, you know, your data buckets? Can, you know, your critical data in that bucket, is it possible for Jenkins to delete the production database, which was like literally one of my original like driving fears for like exploring the space? Because there's solutions available. You can throw SCPs, service control policies to like prevent deletes in production and stuff like this. But, you know, make a list, but I would tie it to like very specific goals. Like we want to be able to prevent account takeovers, and we want to protect our critical data. And like that would be like a great first milestone.
Yeah. So what I do together with Michael, so what we do is every 6 months we have a reminder in our task to-do list, and we basically go into a few of our AWS accounts and we review IAM roles and policies. So, and it's so astonishing. So I think we do a good job of trying to keep, whenever we do a change, we have least privilege in mind, obviously, and we do peer reviews of our source code changes and everything. But still, if you look at an account after 6 months, you always find something that you can improve. That might there might be a small change that was totally legit back 6 months ago, but now you should definitely redo it on stuff like that. So I think this process of re-evaluating your IAM policies and roles is so important, so that you're constantly rethinking about those changes that you did a few months ago, because otherwise, as you said, things accumulate over time, and it really helps to go over them from time to time. And also, you always find areas where you can improve, typically also with little effort. You can have big impact if you think about it from time to time. So this is one thing I found, a good way to handle it.
Yeah. We did a little survey of IAM audit practices, and of the people who are doing audits, they're typically triggered by compliance. You know, whether they're trying to comply with SOC 2 or something like that. Now, a lot of what I consider, it's debatable how much of like IAM access review is required by certain regulations. But understanding, you know, who has privileged access in the account and who has access to critical data and how are you managing credentials, those are all kind of in scope. And so, you know, what people reported is that they're doing IAM access reviews either quarterly or monthly in that time frame. And, you know, I think that, you know, obviously there can be drift. And I think it is useful to, you know, have an assessment done. And like one thing that we built recently is like we built like an IAM assessment like capability in the K9 now. And so like you can just like click a button and have it generated for your latest reports. And I really like reviewing those because it highlights the outstanding issues and, you know, it's a very consistent review. And so I think that, that kind of like, that was one of our first AI forays into AI product. It's really been interesting to see how we can embed expertise around review and cloud security and into a product like that and make it consistent and make it accessible to the people who need to like go fix the thing. Because like one of the neat things is now like we're not just saying like here's a problem. We went through and analyzed all the problems it was finding, and then created quick fix processes for people to like go and like solve the problem. So, you know, we're always trying to like lower the energy required to go improve, actually deliver the fix and like improve the security. Cause like none of this matters unless we actually take action to clean up the account.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this is something that I observed back when we did consulting for large enterprise customers. It was first to get in action, to make the change. Mm-hmm. This is a hurdle that you need to get over. And the second one, I think, is there's always a risk for making changes to your IAM policy and role configurations, because it might be that something breaks that you didn't know about, that you didn't think about because it was not documented or something. And so I think this is the other fear that often hinders organizations from making changes. And probably the only answer to this, I don't know if you have a better one, but the only answer is probably having a CI/CD and automated tests in place, because without that, it's probably hard to make such a change with confidence.
Yeah. Yeah. So one mechanism for eliminating certain classes of risk is to run everything through CI/CD. Because then like you have like, presumably there's some code that is operating deterministically and consistently, right? And so, you know, you're eliminating like the click ops sort of changes, but there's also the risk of, there's also risks around just like missing things. So in some other work that I'm doing, like we're trying to see if we can solve problems with just cloud security findings in general. And like some of the research that's required to verify whether a finding still exists or to remediate it safely is really kind of astounding. Like if you want to like remove a security group, you end up having to check with like, I'll take a guess here, it's like 7 other services, like Lambda, like whether that security group is being used, Lambda, RDS. You can probably name it better than I can, given the stuff you've written. But it was really kind of astounding. I was just like watching the agent sort of do this research, and it just like kept going and going and going. I'm like, oh wow, those are all like legit dependencies that security groups, those are legit services that can depend on security groups. And like, I would not thought of half of them.
Yeah, absolutely. So you already mentioned a little bit what you're currently working on, Stephen. So I'm very interested in that. So what is the topic or the problem that you are working on those days?
Yeah. So historically, every security tool on the market competed the best signal generator. And so we have all these findings. And, you know, a lot of times they get thrown over the wall from or like into a cloud or platform or DevOps engineer's lap to like, hey, go fix this thing. And so what we're doing is we're trying to see if we can help the organization out generally and cloud engineers specifically by triaging those findings, validating that they still exist, assessing the risk according to like a standardized model like NIST, you know, NIST 830, go research the remediation and like find like the steps to solve the problem with the AWS CLI and infrastructure code. And like the big idea here is that we want to, you know, build that last mile to eliminate the noise and help cloud engineers actually go from a validated finding to a confirmed fix in minutes.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds cool. So I think that's probably what everyone who works with tools like the Security Hub or Wiz or all of those tools that they have built a really very helpful automations that constantly check your AWS and other configurations. Mm-hmm. And but that's a good side of things. We have those tools helping us to keep track of everything. But then they create so much notifications and alerts that it's really hard to filter from the noise and find the relevant stuff and also then fix it.
Right.
So I've seen, so this was always in larger organizations. So I've seen that they had really thousands and tens thousands of findings in their accounts and the teams. So if you, then someone did the calculation, how much time would it take to go really through all the list and fix all those findings if every finding takes 5 minutes and they ended up with years of work. So I think it's really important to kind of prioritize and also then help to fix those things. And I think, again, you have the same problem that we discussed before, because sometimes to fix is easy. It seems to be easy. So it says, enable this in S3 configuration. And you can just click it. But it's possible that this breaks something, this little change,
right,
because some other services was relying on this configuration
right
being turned off or something.
Right.
And so you cannot, it's really hard to focus on the important stuff and then also to make those changes with confidence. And as you said, you have to check so many dependencies of this specific resource, and there's so much things that many engineers don't know about because they're not so deep also in AWS details.
Yeah. So what you describe is a very common story. I've heard the term Security Hub bankruptcy a few times. you know, there's just not much you can even, the first task is to create signal, is to clean up the signal in the noise. Yeah. And, you know, one of my first aha moments was, the tools, a lot of the tools, the scanner tools, they kind of stop at signal generation where like, oh, here's a finding. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously a lot of them are now building into the remediation space as well. But you know, historically a lot of tools, you know, they'll generate a finding and then create a JIRA ticket. Everyone does that. Now once that JIRA ticket is created, there's a lot of other problems that may have occurred. One, that may have been a duplicate. And we hear this a lot with, you know, tools that are run or scans that are run on a like quarterly basis for compliance or something, engineers complaining about false positives and like just seeing the same false positives every quarter. And then, you know, they have to say like, okay, this is a false positive, and they got to acknowledge it again. They got to close it out. There's another problem of like, well, once it gets into a JIRA or GitHub issue, it's like, well, we've got to route it to the right person or team. Routing is totally broken. I'm hearing, and in organizations with like more than three teams. It's just like a total mess. Now there are some data sources, like some organizations have a tool like Backstage that have associated owners with different projects and so forth. But you know, there are other complications, especially as the organization grows. Like if you have a vulnerability in say an overly permissive security group for an application running on ECS. Well, okay, but there's a platform team and many application teams. Okay, well, does the vulnerability get routed to the application team, or does it get routed to the platform team, which probably owns the module that is managing the security groups? So this is like, this is a question that matters you know, to like a mid-sized company with 100 plus engineers. And so, you know, a lot of what we're thinking about is, you know, not just like how to go and research the remediation, but like the real workflow impacts and integrations, which like, hey, before we create an issue, we need to go look and see if an issue already exists for this, tie it back up with history. Like, so you can think of it as deduplication in one sense. We're going to validate that the issues still exist in the AWS account and just like close it. That was a huge aha. Like if it doesn't exist anymore, just close it. And like, you know, update Security Hub and Jira and whatever, right? Like go do the bookkeeping. That's a huge time saver. And like, when I saw that happen for the first time, I was like, yes, thank you. You know, do other things with like making sure that cleaning up the noise and eliminating stale issues and just making sure that what an engineer is looking at is like a fully researched solution. So that they don't have to spend so much time analyzing, they can and researching, they can spend the time on deciding whether to press the fix this with the CLI option or looking at a pull request to fix up some infrastructure code. So, you know, we built a prototype and have been showing it around to people, and there's been some excitement. So we're excited about that really interested to see where that goes.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like a really an interesting product that you're building, because what I think is oftentimes when I look, when I work with customers, and especially the larger ones, the enterprise customers, they basically have a whole team often that is only doing assigning tickets, fixing duplicates, all that you mentioned. So it's such a lot of administrative work that is not really requiring an information security specialist. It's just work that you get out of those systems that generate all those issues and tickets for you. But just assigning them and manually figuring out if it's necessary to fix them or you can close them, it takes so much time and distracts from working on the real problem or on the real challenge of increasing the security of your infrastructure and application. So I think to automate those tasks as much as possible, this could really be a big game changer for so many teams. And I'm really looking forward to what you are building here. And you definitely need to come back here to the podcast and present your solution after you are ready to do so. And I'm also keen to try it out myself. So that's really cool.
Yeah, well, we'll set that up because we've already got it deployed to AWS and working on integrating some feedback. Some things I learned, built an eval suite, and I published a blog post about how we built an eval suite over the past couple of weeks. to verify that the agent is finding the right things in research, that it's formatting its output in a consistent way. Because of course, like, we're building for humans, right? So we're not as a builder using AI, what we're automating is the research and much of the analysis, with the intent to serve people and help and enable people to do their jobs better, right? And actually, you know, a point that I want to make here is that, like, we're designing the output for humans. You know, we're obviously, there's going to be some outputs that are consumable by machines as well, but ultimately we're trying to enable people to make great decisions, and we need to respect their time. So, you know, as writers, you know, I think, and readers, we appreciate being able to, communicate clearly and consistently, so that, like, the agent should be, we're building it to be a teammate. So it should behave consistently and, like, format its output in the same ways and, like, use the same sort of language, and be relatively consistent, when analyzing her findings, so that, like, you can become accustomed to it and focus on, like, what it's saying rather than, like, the format of the message and stuff like this. And I was probably, like, a long exposition for something that some people might consider a nuance, but, like, we're still building for people and to enable people to get things done and, like, yeah, you know, make things more secure. But, like, as I said before, like, if we don't structure things so the fix actually gets out to production, the value hasn't been delivered.
Mm. Yeah.
So we need to make that easy. And we need to, like, as the automation becomes, you know, we can scale the automation far more than we can scale the people. So we still need to pay attention to things like the human attention budget and, like, how many issues can we have, can we be surfacing to people at a given time? Because, like, we all know, like, even, like, I have, like, Dependabot right now, like, it can only have at most one issue open or one PR open, mm-hmm. because, like, that's all mm-hmm. I can handle. So, like, there's, you know, we have to respect the constraint, which is still human attention. But I think we also have the opportunity to measure things better and, like, measure, like, actual improvements delivered to production, risk mitigated, hopefully in, like, a monetary, like, this is how much risk was mitigated this week, or this is how much risk we have outstanding in our production environment in terms of euros. So anyway,
I'm ready. Yeah. Yeah. So I want to pick up a question from the LinkedIn chat. So Frank here is asking, so that oftentimes, because IM is so hard to get right, when you do project work and you have tough deadlines, oftentimes it seems like there is not enough time to basically get your IAM policies right and to follow least privilege. And then at the end, you have just wild cards everywhere in your mm-hmm. policies, allowing access to everything. So what's your advice on how to, basically it's allocate the time that you have in your projects to security relevant tasks, like building your IAM policies, and basically balance that with finishing the project, meeting your deadlines. So do you have any, so I don't know if there's an answer, but do you have any advice on how to talk to your project manager, or how do you get that accomplished?
So this goes back to the number one's a great question. It's a super important question. And I'll even go back to refer to my original answer of, like, how do you prioritize security or IAM improvement efforts and IAM assessment and least privilege, right? So I think as an application engineering team, the first priority you want to do is you want to make sure that your data sources are protected. And so to this end, that's rule number one. Rule number two, you probably don't have time to write a least privilege policy for a data source within like the normal scope of a project, because doing like actual least privilege, if you write it by hand, like, and I like to say, like, friends don't let friends write KMS key policy. use a generator. We've published them like for free on GitHub, you know, for Terraform, for CDK. But like, you know, it took me weeks to write the KMS policy generator, the S3 policy generator, and so forth. Now, would it be faster now with LLMs and so forth? Yeah, probably. But what I think is a more practical approach is use a policy generator that lets you express what you want data, how you want data to be accessible in a high level language, you know, administer resource, read config, read data, write data, delete data. And let the policy generator generate the policy. And then you're not dependent on a single expert either, understanding what that policy does. Everyone can understand what this should be doing in the encoder view and so forth. And let a library handle it. Now, maybe it's not the one from K9, that's fine. I recommend getting some sort of library, even if you develop it on your own. Hopefully you do enough consistent work that like you've got some reasonable infrastructure code there, whether it's in CDK or Terraform or Pulumi or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then on the identity side, try to scope it to the permissions that you need. If you can, scope it to the resources that are relevant just to that application. That does get a little tricky depending on like how good whatever templating system is you're using and like how strong your naming conventions actually are. But protect your data first. I would start there.
Yeah.
And I talk about this in the book, chapter 5, using AWS, the good parts, and like essentially creating data perimeters. Because like one of the tricks with resource policy is to deny unintended access. And you can do that with resource policy. You can deny unintended access to the data resource, which is what the attacker is probably after. And you can really only do that in practice with resource policy, because fixing all your identity policies is just not, it's probably not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I like the advice. And it's, I think it's, if you have the data sources are the most valuable assets in your AWS accounts.
Yeah.
And so to protect them and try to use resource policies for having a simple setup, definitely a solution to the problem here.
Yeah.
Thanks. So, Stephen, I want to play a quick game with you.
Oh,
So we already discussed the AWS Security Hub and all the findings it generates.
Yeah.
And behind Security Hub, there is a growing and growing list of security controls.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you think about it, but I think some of them are really, really helpful. And some of them are just creating much noise. Uh-huh. Let's put it like that. So I want to play a little game with you, quick fire. So the idea is that I bring up a security control from Security Hub, and you very quickly, without putting too much thought and any explanation, just answer with, this is critical or this is a distraction. So this is the idea. So the important thing here is that you answer real quick.
Mm-hmm.
So we won't judge you.
Okay.
But the idea is that you just make a very quick decision,
mm-hmm.
Whether this is something critical or probably something you can skip. And to make it a little easier for you, if you cannot decide quickly if it's important or not, you can say, I want to skip this question. And you can do so 5 times.
Okay.
I've prepared 50 security controls and we go over them quickly. Okay.
Let's do it.
Okay. Let's do it. Okay. So let's start. I am root user access key should not exist.
Critical.
Log metric filter and alarm for root table changes.
Distracting.
EC2 instances should use IMDS version 2.
Critical or up there. Yeah, do it.
Password policy requires at least one lowercase letter.
Distracting.
Security groups should not allow unrestricted access to high-risk ports.
Critical.
CloudFront distributions should have origin failover configured.
Distracting.
S3 buckets should prohibit public read access.
Critical, but there are exceptions.
EC2 instances should not use multiple elastic network interfaces.
Distracting.
CloudTrail should be enabled with multi-region trial.
That's important. That's good. Do that.
Log metric filter for changes to network access control lists.
Distracting.
Secrets should not be passed as container environment variables.
Critical.
Classic load balancers should have connection training enabled.
Distracting, nice to have.
IAM policies should not allow full administrative privileges.
I mean, critical, but you have to.
Yeah.
Somebody
API gateway REST API stages should have X-ray tracing enabled.
Distracting.
Guard duties should be enabled.
Yeah, I think for most people, yes, critical.
Unused EC2 elastic IPs should be removed.
Critical. I mean, it's not critical, but like you're going to pay for them if you don't.
Yeah. EVS snapshot should not be publicly restorable.
Critical, sure.
Log metric filter for VPC changes.
Distracting.
ECS clusters should use container insights.
I wish it was less expensive. distracting.
Security groups should not allow ingress from 000/0 to port 22.
Distracting.
Autoscaling groups should use multiple instance types in multiple availability zones.
Critical.
CloudTrail S3 bucket should not be publicly accessible.
Critical.
Elastic Beanstalk should have enhanced health reporting enabled.
I don't know.
We can skip it. AWS config should be enabled.
Critical.
Log metric filter for changes to network gateways.
Distracting.
ECR private repos should have image scanning configured.
Yes, critical.
Unused IAM user credentials should be removed.
Critical.
Stopped EC2 instances should be removed after a specified time.
I mean, distracting.
Code build environment variables should not contain clear text credentials.
What should not contain? I mean,
critical. Sorry, code build environment variables should not contain. Sorry.
Yeah, critical.
EKS cluster endpoints should not be publicly accessible.
Uh, Yeah, I mean, I know that definitely don't want them, but like it's critical.
Okay. S3 access logging on the CloudTrail S3 bucket enabled.
Yes, critical.
Elasticsearch domains should not be publicly accessible.
Non-critical, distracting.
MFA should be enabled for the root user of the account, AWS account.
Critical, and you have no choice.
CloudFront distributions should use custom SSL TLS certificates.
Critical, critical.
Okay. Yeah. So I think this is about not using the default domain
Yeah,
name,
right. So it's
probably.
on AWS.
Okay.
Sure.
So to be honest, so there was a lot of critical stuff in there, actually. So I think there's definitely coming good advice from CloudTrail. I think what's interesting is that some of the security controls seems like a little outdated to me. So, for example, we had those CloudWatch metric filters for something, where there are definitely better tools those days than having those configurations configured. And I think it's also what strikes me about those Security Hub controls is they are very AWS vendor specific, and they just they kind of push you into using specific AWS services where there might be alternatives. So following them very strictly is typically pushing you that way, and there might be better solutions nowadays and more modern ways of doing things as well. So that's maybe a summary of those controls that we went over.
Yeah, I agree. And what I it would be interesting to see like if you could set a profile or something like I'm developing serverless applications. So you know you essentially you can probably skip the VPC stuff. I mean, not that it's, I guess, flagging if there's not a not resources there, but yeah, like you can really get lost in like the noise of like NACLs and so forth. And yeah, I agree that there has historically been sometimes a push to like, oh, enable MACI. Like,
Which costs you an arm and a leg, right?
And speaking of config, like you need to be careful on the costs there, and especially the new Security Hub. And you know, going back to serverless, like it's like priced like per lambda, or each lambda is a is priced. And so you know, we you know have serverless applications. We have a lot of functions, and you know, we're doing like. You know, deploying a full deployment per branch, and it's like Security Hub costs like a good chunk of money there.
Absolutely.
So you know, you also need to be aware of the costs, and like, you know, it's many of those controls have cost implications. So this is actually something I'm thinking about with the agent too, like. Here's the remediation, and can we give guidance on what this might cost?
Yeah, very good.
That
Yeah,
you're
that's
not
important.
surprised.
Yeah, absolutely. You can get into trouble so quickly. So a few weeks ago, I for testing purposes, I created I think five or a lot of really a lot of API gateway resources just for some testing. And then later, the bill for AWS Config increased so dramatically because I created so many resources that now were under management or under control of AWS Config. And so you can qu really quickly run into troubles.
So I've run into
So.
similar problems, especially with config, and I will say that Claude was very helpful. Claude Code was very helpful in helping me scope the filters or whatever they call it down to only track the resources that made sense in our development account, especially. Because yeah, we were, you know, we also have API Gateway was one of them, but like, you know, we got all these, we were spending more on config and Security Hub than all the other stuff combined in our dev account, and until sort of right-sized it.
Okay, Stephen, so this was really a good ride through AWS security IAM. So I want to close this podcast episode asking you about something, because I know that you are really into reading non-technical and technical books. So I definitely have to ask you about book recommendations, about books that you have been reading through recently and that you want to recommend.
Yeah. So here are a couple. Exactly What to Say by Phil Jones. You know, as a business owner, I do a lot of marketing, sales, email, follow-up, and so forth. So Exactly What to Say does exactly what it describes on the cover, is it gives you turns of phrases to help you get decisions and answers to questions that you're trying to get. So like when you are trying to, for example, get the response to a question, you might say, it looks like you've been busy, because you're trying to handle the objection for why they haven't responded yet. But I was wondering if you could when would be a good time for you to follow up with me on that question I asked? And would, you know, Tuesday afternoon work for you? And so you're doing a lot of things there, like you're like assuming, like you're assuming they're going to do it, and like putting, you're baking that in there. You are, you know, giving a specific date that, you know, they're going to know that you're like, you're going to follow up on, and so forth. So, you know, there's a lot of like great little formulas that have helped me communicate more precisely and effectively, especially when negotiating things, which we all do in our daily lives, you know, outside of marketing and sales too. But like, I use this with my kids sometimes. and then another great book that I listened to on the way to reInvent this year is called Super Communicators. And the idea is to, you know, pick up some additional skills for how to build relationships with people and like establish rapport. And like, instead of, you know, a lot of people are afraid of, you know, going to a conference or a party or whatever. And like, who am I going to talk to? What am I going to talk to you about? And it gives you some ideas about how to just genuinely relate to other people at a human level. Like, you know, when usually a common question, like when getting to know somebody at a professional event, like, what, you know, what's your role? You know, what do you do? And, you know, what are you focused on, maybe? Well, a way to kind of like get more personal about that is when they answer and you say like, like kind of like you did, actually exactly like what you did at the beginning of this call, like, why did I get into building canine security and getting into IAM? Like, you asked me, like, what brought me there? You can ask them, like, why did you become a cloud engineer? What, you know, I bet there was something in your history, like some moment where you're like, oh, that seems like a great idea. Or like, I'm inspired. Like, what inspired you to do that thing that you've now committed 40 hours or whatever per week to? And let people tell their story. And, you know, because like a lot of stories start with, you know, my grandmother did this, or, my uncle did that, or, you know, so forth. So, you know, there's an inspiration there. And that is, that's one of the ways that Charles Duhigg talks about, like, how to relate and learn to relate to people just like as humans.
Perfect. Perfect. Thank you very much for those book recommendations. I will definitely check them out. So it was a pleasure, Stephen. Thanks for joining me for the show. That's it. We'll be back soon. Subscribe to the CloudOnOut newsletter, podcast, or the YouTube channel to make sure you don't miss the upcoming shows. We're also looking forward to your feedback. hello@cloudonout.io, or find us on LinkedIn and Mastodon. I will put all the links where you can find Stephen in the show notes and video description as well. So find him in the internet and contact him, for example, via LinkedIn. So thanks for joining me today, Stephen.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the ability to come on this show and talk about cloud security and just catch up on everything that's been going on. Thanks for having me.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Bye.